It's a pleasure to welcome back alternative economist John Williams to the show. He's helped investors for decades keep ahead of the trends in the markets with his alternative economic projections. Welcome back, John Williams.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You have prepared and issued your latest report at ShadowStats.
Well, this is an unusually comprehensive one because there are a number of factors that are facing us. I'll contend that we're heading in a new recession, one that effectively probably started in fourth quarter of 2018. But when I say started, that was the peak in activity. So that maybe November, but certainly for the quarter would appear to be the peak in activity. And then you'll start to see quarterly contractions in the first quarter, second quarter of 2019. Expectations are the first quarter's going to be on the plus side. The ranges are from 1.4% up to 2.8%, I believe. And that's against 2.2% growth in the fourth quarter. You've had a very difficult time here in economic reporting that's been heavily disrupted by the government shutdown. A lot of key series such as retail sales, the trade deficit, new orders for durable goods, they were, and the home sales, the construction series, all terribly disrupted because of the shutdown data was not gathered at the right time. Been trying to piece it back together, and you've had all sorts of funny numbers. And so people have made a lot of assumptions, and I think there'll be some downside surprises when everything's counted here. I believe, given the way the Bureau of Economic Analysis operates, and they're the people who report the GDP, that they always tend to target the consensus, and the consensus is unusually broad at the moment, but when they're looking at something lower or some downside revisions, they'll tend to go to the low side of consensus. So I think we'll see in this something that's for the first quarter currently below consensus, and that'll probably turn negative in the next several months of reporting. In fact, come July, I think it's July 26th, you'll get a revision, a benchmark revision, which I believe will take the fourth quarter growth down from its current 2.2% level, still positive. I think by then you'll see the first quarter negative, and you'll also get the initial reporting of the second quarter, which I believe will be negative, which will give you the basis for a formal recession. The reason you're seeing the economy slow down is that the Federal Reserve has tightened monetary policy rather extensively in the last year or so. Starting back in December of 2017, every quarter they're raising interest rates by a quarter of a percent. And although the Fed said, oh, that's a minimal amount, given where the market had been at low rates for such a long period of time, from where they started that quarterly raising, it effectively doubled interest rates. And that and cutting back on systemic liquidity squeezed the consumer. Consumers, three-quarters of the economy. And you're beginning to see those numbers falter before they shut down the government. And there's nothing to indicate, really, that the consumer is doing any better than he was. So I think you're going to see that as the numbers settle out here that you entered a recession. And where the Fed recognizes that. They responded to the way the stock market was going at the end of the year, and they have their own internal forecast. If they saw a booming economy ahead, they wouldn't have intervened in their policy and said, oh, we're putting on hold any further interest rate increases this year, being in 2019. They were looking to hike the rate, the Fed funds rate, another quarter point for 2 to 3 quarters anyway. And now they're not looking at anything. So they've got an internal GDP forecast, I think, which shows it down. And with that, you've got all sorts of distortions in the marketplace, very dangerous times. You've got people hyping how great the economy is and the stock market's at all-time highs, and that's all fine and dandy, but the economy is not as advertised, and the stock market will end up following what I believe, what the Fed's looking at here, because the if I'm right on where the economy's going here, not only is the Fed not going to be hiking rates for the rest of the year, but they're going to start easing again, probably by September. And as they start pulling back on interest rates, and maybe even go to quantitative easing, but as they start to lower interest rates, that will hit the dollar hard. Because you have a lot of foreign capital in the U.S. market, it'll flee for safer ground abroad. That'll also be very inflationary in the United States. As the dollar weakens, that spikes commodity prices such as oil. We're already seeing some of that, as the inflation rises, all that becomes negative for the bond market. And in the case of the dollar here, also for the stock market, because people will be seeking safety outside the dollar. So that you, as the dollar sinks, you get higher inflation, particularly from the oil. The oil prices have driven our inflation rate for the last several years anyway. And that's very bullish for gold. And that is, well, as I'm looking forward here, I'm not so hot on the domestic stock or bond market. I'm not hot on the U.S. dollar. I think the U.S. dollar is going to take a hit. And as a result, you've got a circumstance here that probably is very bullish for gold. But it's something that's not anticipated. The Fed has been trying to get out of a bad situation it had back in 2008 with the banking system collapse. And that's why they were raising rates, but now they've had to pull back on that. So they don't have a stable circumstance. It's fraught with all sorts of dangers here, but just looking ahead in the near future, I'm looking at a very unstable financial markets, a weak dollar, and a rapidly slowing U.S. economy.
How does the 50-year low on national unemployment, how does that factor into your work? Do you feel that this number is either artificial and or do you then expect for this type of record figure to start to deteriorate and the feds will, you know, follow their typical playbook guide of lowering rates and increasing quantitative easing?
The Fed has a pretty good sense of what's happening in the economy. And if you look at the unemployment rate, the headline unemployment rate, the U3 unemployment rate, that's indeed at multi-year lows. But that's in the context of some indications of labor market stress that are sort of at highs that you see only during recessions. Back in you go back to the the date they changed. It's 1990, I think, was the time when the 1994. That's when NAFTA had been put in place, and they decided at that point in time to redefine the unemployment numbers. And while the headline unemployment number, the guy that's has stayed effectively the same in its definition, you have backup inflation numbers with people who have not been able to get work in a while. They used to have count people who were discouraged workers and continue counting them until they got a job or dropped out of the labor force completely for other reasons. And what they redefined in 1994 was that, well, you're only discouraged for a year. After that, we just don't count you. And that had the effect of lowering the secondary unemployment rate, which would have been moved higher in the post-NAFTA environment as jobs were lost offshore and people just couldn't get work. They couldn't get the type of jobs you're looking for, and they retained were ongoing discouraged workers instead of being, although they've been redefined out of existence by the government's numbers. I look at estimating the where things would be had they not made those changes in definition. And where your headline unemployment rate right now, let's say, is around 3%, you're looking at a broader rate of maybe 7%, which is their headline number, and up closer to 20% if you look at what it would be if they counted everyone who had been defined out of existence and still would be looking for a job. So the underlying unemployment, big picture, is not real strong. And where you see confirmation of that is in areas such as the employment to population ratio, or the participation rate, which is the ratio of people who are employed and unemployed to the population. And what you're seeing there are levels that we're at an all-time low, effectively, with the headline unemployment rate. That's a point in time where historically, before they redefined things here, that you'd also be at an all-time high with the participation rate or with the employment-to-population ratio. What we're seeing are those numbers off historic lows. They're at levels that are much more consistent with an ongoing recession and with unemployment quite high. And if you work out the numbers, what you'll see is that those are numbers that involve the population. And the issue here is that the reason you're seeing those numbers out of whack is that you have a higher portion of the population, which is now counted as unemployed in the broader unemployment measure. And you work that versus mine, you'll find that my estimate of pretty much accounts for why you have this dichotomy between what used to be consistent numbers, the unemployment measure, versus the participation rate in terms of where you were in the cycle, and why you're not seeing it now. And that's because you have a lot of people who are no longer being counted in the broad unemployment picture.
If you're expecting an economic downturn, investors could be caught flat-footed, particularly U.S. equities investors. What do you see as the go-to market when this starts to unfold?
My forecast on the stock market traditionally have not been stellar. I can tell you where the general pressures are going to be. Business conditions are going to be good. Business conditions are not going to be good. Earnings are not going to be good. And then you get all sorts of games played with the Fed, where they cut rates and the games people come in and manipulate the markets. You have other problems with the system here, which get hurt by a recession. Very specifically, the budget deficit and the government's ability to cover its own finances. And there you have risks that tend to threaten long-term financial stability, inflation, and again, areas that would tend to make you not want to be in the dollar or have some kind of an investment that would be stable against the real purchasing power of the dollar, and that brings you back to the precious metals. Right now the inflation numbers are not real. They're about as real as the broad unemployment rate. But something here you might find of interest. The government started redefining inflation back in the 1980s with the effect of lowering the rate of inflation through a number of definitions of how products were surveyed or how the prices were defined or the quality was defined. And we right now have headline inflation you're running somewhat over 2%. If you look at inflation the way it used to be before they started playing games with us, you'd be up closer to 10%. Now, that's a big difference, and the reason the government made these changes, and they're very open about it, discussed before Congress, Greenspan was backing it at the time, as Bandura back during the Clinton administration. The idea was that, inflation really is wrong. The number they were using, it overstates inflation, and if only we could make the number right, which would be lower, a lower inflation, That would cost us less and help narrow the budget deficit for areas of expense such as cost of living adjustments for people on Social Security or federal pensions. And Braun was a measure of bailed out corporations like General Motors. The Fed bought AIG, the largest insurance company in the world. They did everything they could to keep the system from crashing. And the biggest factor was those mortgage-backed securities that brought effectively a number of banks to bankruptcy. The system was failing. Now, what the Fed did there was they introduced quantitative easing, very, very creative, and it worked to stabilize the banks. Because what the Fed did was they bought up about $5 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities in U.S. Treasuries from the banking system. That flooded the banking system with cash. Now, normally, when the Fed is trying to stimulate the economy or stimulate the money supply, what they'll do is they'll buy treasuries from the banking system. That gives the banks cash, and the banks then lend that out, and with a multiplier effect with the reserve balances, that expands the money supply and helps to expand the economy. What they did here, had it been a parallel, okay, we'll just take this cash and put it into the system, you would have had a hyperinflation. What they did instead was they told the banks they couldn't lend it back out into the system, but had to lend it back to the bank, to the Federal Reserve Bank, the central bank, and the central bank would pay them interest on their excess reserves. So the Fed created the cash for them, borrowed the cash back from them, paid them interest on it, and kept the banking system afloat. Problem was that they didn't allow for the normal course of lending and economic recovery. The concentration was saving the banks and not the economy per se. So the average guy still has problems getting mortgages. Main Street USA never saw much of an economic recovery. You saw a recovery on Wall Street, but you look at major economic sectors such as manufacturing, U.S. manufacturing. Biggest portion of the biggest sector of the U.S. economy never recovered. This is as reported by the Federal Reserve. The way they measure the economy, or when using economic terms, you have a peak of economic activity, and you determine that because then the economy starts to slow down. As it turns off its peak, which I think happened here in the fourth quarter, that's a recession. It's a recession until you hit a trough. Then you rally off the trough, and the economy recovers until it gets to its pre-recession high. It's recovering until it recovers the prior high. And then once it goes beyond the prior high, which usually it does, that's called economic expansion. Well, you look at industrial production, and that's a particularly interesting series, because with the industrial production and the dominant manufacturing sector there, you have 100 years of history. It's the longest published major U.S. economic indicator around. Never in the 100-year history of the series have you had what's now 135 consecutive months of economic non-expansion. This is longer than we've seen with the Great Depression or any other downturn in economic history in the last century. So that's why some people are not sensing that there's a really strong economy here. Guess what? The construction sector is seeing the same thing. The housing market, no recovery there. Same thing. Many of the measures there, the home sales, the housing starts, they're down 50% from their pre-recession peak. Industrial production is down about 4%. And you take aggregate production, it is up 5 or 6% because of a boom in the oil industry, which is one positive sector in the production area. But what makes you wonder about it a little bit is that if you look at the GDP, the formal measure, this is the headline number on the economy and the one that the Fed likes to work with, that's up 19.2% from its pre-recession low. But there's nothing else that's up that much. I don't care what you can look at, the employment numbers, retail sales. I mean, there are a number of measures that are above their pre-recession highs, but nothing close to what's being reported for the GDP. So I'm very suspect of the GDP, and where that comes into play is in how they define the inflation, because right now they're understating the GDP by about 2 percentage points. And in terms of its, the underlying inflation, the implicit price deflator, GDP inflation, they're understating that by about 2 percentage points, which means it's artificially adding about 2 percentage points to the real growth, the inflation-adjusted growth. And the difference that makes is that if you look at it as though they hadn't understated inflation, it takes on the same pattern that you see in manufacturing. Plunge, some recovery, but you know economic expansion. I mean, there are areas that have expanded, and they're generally tied to the financial markets. The economy's fine and recovering, but he said it wasn't.
One of the areas that you've covered closely, inflation, and in particular, say, economic history and just how inflation has maybe crafted, you know, the way we look back at just some of the deluges and implosions we've seen in the markets seem to follow runaway prices and even stagflation, hyperinflation. Some people have tried to argue if we ignore the Continental back in the 1700s, and then again if we ignore the Civil War and the fallout there, we've never really experienced a hyperinflation in the United States. Can you outline a plausible scenario where that might actually come to pass? Because, you know, usually it's what people are least expecting that oftentimes occurs in the economy.
Well, it is, again, just as a quick point, if you look at the, again, in my current newsletter, I've got a plot of inflation back to the 1600s the Americas and into the United States after it's created. And what you'll find is that you generally get some spike in inflation around wars. You had some spike in inflation around the California gold rushes. New gold got pumped into the economy. But those, you know, it's up and down, and inflation effectively is flat over time until the Fed was founded, and then you start to see a little bit pick up in the early 1900s. Not bad. Then in Roosevelt takes us off the gold standard, domestic gold standard. It starts then to accelerate a little bit, and Nixon takes us off the closes the gold window, and all of a sudden really starts to take off. And that's just with the headline inflation. Then if you look in the early 80s, when the government starts playing with the inflation rate to keep it down, you see then the inflation sort of straight is a straight line, but the way it would have been is taken up exponentially, and so does gold. So gold tends to reflect what people are actually experiencing with their purchasing power. That's worked out consistently over now centuries. And, I mean, you can still buy a loaf of bread today for the same amount of gold you could buy it for back in ancient Rome. Same thing with silver. It's a store of wealth. As a store of wealth, if you don't have any inflation, that's that's fine. You've got all sorts of fine investments that you can make. But if you're in a highly inflationary society, and here's what we're seeing is that, number one, there really is underlying inflation here. It's just not being fully reported. But going forward, we're in a circumstance where the federal government is effectively insolvent. Now, in order to not have a hyperinflation in the United States, what has to be done is the system has to be brought into balance between what the government's committed to spend over the next 70 years, let's say, in terms of Medicare and Social Security. That stuff's already established. They've worked out the numbers on it. In order to cover what we need to cover today, what we're committed to, looking at the hard numbers that are deflated for inflation, cost of money, we need $100 trillion in place today for the federal government. We don't have that. Now, so that's either, as Greenspan once suggested, if the economy is, you don't have to worry about the U.S. ever defaulting on its Well, it's that because everything it owes is in dollars, and we can always print as many dollars as we want. That is one solution going forward, but that creates a hyperinflation, and the dollar becomes worthless. Ideally, you want to have the system in fiscal balance and being able to cover your expenses and your revenues and somewhat in balance over time. I mean, different things you can adjust for to try and make up for unusual times. But we're right now far out of balance. Again, you have our Treasury Secretary, Mnuchin. You've got our Federal Reserve Chairman, Powell, both describing the Treasury's fiscal condition as not sustainable. The government just put out its financial report, the U.S. Treasury did. It's non-sustainable. We have to make these changes. So what do you do? How do you? What changes do you have to make? Well, basically, you have to bring the Medicare and Social Security obligations into balance against the revenues. And the way you do that is that you raise the taxes, you raise the cash flowing in, and you reduce the expenses, what you put out. So you're reducing the benefits and you're increasing the taxes, and I challenge you to find more than two or three politicians that are willing to do that right now in Washington. They have to act now. The longer they wait, the more expensive it gets, and I just don't see the political will to do it. They'll keep pushing it off into the future. The more they push it off into the future, the worse the problem gets. And eventually, you either get a very severe realignment of taxes and revenues and what people are getting out of the system, or as Greenspan suggested, we just print the money as we need it, and if you print the number and the money as you need it, that's where you get the hyperinflation, and that's where we're headed if the system can't be brought into balance. I hope it can be brought into balance. It has to be brought into balance for everyone's good, because you really don't want to see what happens here if we end up in a hyperinflation.
Well, not to mention, I mean, eventually the system will right itself. It's as inevitable as a ship, if you will, if you want to use the Titanic analogy. But, I mean, eventually it must right or it must capsize. And I think our officials have no intention on allowing the ship to capsize. So the only means left at their disposal is to try to keep printing and quantitative easing. So that really leads, I think, to the key takeaway. If the currencies of the world, let's ignore cryptos, which I believe are now direct parallel competitors with fiat money, but that's really a completely different discussion for a different day. But let's just assume that the fiat money of the world was reevaluated to the more traditional metric of gold, gold and silver, as the base money supply. Can you give us a guesstimate, a back-of-the-envelope idea of just how high gold and or silver might have to be priced for the fiat money to meet its current obligations?
Well, it all depends on how far down the road it goes before they try to do something. I can tell you that let me put it this way, we've already had a hyperinflation, although people haven't seen it because it's been over a period of time. Again, if you took $100 in gold back in 1900, and $100 in U.S. dollar bills, forget any gold backing, but just the dollar per se, and looked at them today, you could and put it back in terms of the value of 1900 and where you are today, gold would still be worth $100, but the dollar would be worth 4 cents. So let's say that's 25 times to the dollar times 100. So it'd suggest gold would be around $2,500. Oh my goodness, that's my point here is it's all relative to how cheap the dollar is going. The gold retains the same purchasing power that it had back, and it retains that $100 of purchasing power of 1900, as opposed to the 4 cents that the dollar has. It's just a matter of how far over time you want to go. It's an ounce of gold is an ounce of gold, and it'll buy the same thing today as it did 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, you've done a very good job giving us an overview of just how, you know, the traditional suit for a business person, if you will, maybe we should say a toga, back in the times, Roman period there. I mean, essentially a suit, approximately 1 ounce of gold, even today, that's the kind of the standard. And are there any other markets you're concerned about? I mean, we've heard talk of an echo bubble, at least regionally here in the United States on real estate. There are some frothy looking numbers if we take a look at the Case-Shiller indexes in particular for individual cities. Any comments there?
Well, real estate has a basic economic demand behind it, but it's also a real asset and of limited supply. You know, if you get real high high demand in certain areas, the prices will go up on a relative basis. But again, it's generally always a very good hedge against inflation. Just lacks the portability and the liquidity of gold under certain circumstances. It is in terms of how it gets affected by the economy. I think the economy here is going to get a lot worse. So that might tend to bring down the demand some, might tend to bring prices down some. And indeed, you can get highly inflated prices even there. But over time, there's a real value that is realizable. It's not going from $100 to 4 cents. And depending upon how the economy is going, you'll go around a certain constant value in terms of purchasing power. Real estate's one other area that I would look to have money in, as long as you're not worried about liquidity if times get tight. It will retain its value.
And as far as the global equities markets, do you feel that since, you know, we've been the best game in town, our U.S. shares market, do you think that will change and folks should be looking abroad?
Frankly, I would tend to avoid the equity markets, or that I'd have as my pocket gambling money. I mean, you can always make good money in certain deals in crazy circumstances, and over time, I mean, certainly stocks have been somewhat of a hedge in inflation as well. Not as good as gold. The problem is that you have fiat currencies around the world, so that there may be some global issues here in terms of the paper money and some relative currency values. I still like the Swiss franc, even though they don't have the backing they had.
With so few people positioned in gold today, I mean, in the safe haven assets, you know, the risk-on trade remains the trade of the day. In that type of scenario, and with so many people up to their eyeballs in debt, several reports now coming from the Fed itself that very few families in the United States don't even have $1,000 in cash available for emergencies, let alone any money to invest in precious metals. Do you see this as a socioeconomic disaster setting up here, or will our policymakers somehow come in and resolve this at the last minute?
Well, a lot of it's been self-created by our policymakers. I mean, what they did in redefining inflation was that they guaranteed impoverishment of people who were living on Social Security. They cut the cost of living adjustments very, very deliberately by percentage points from where they should have been, and they nobody seems to complain about it. I mean, if you happen to live on Social Security, I hear a lot of complaints about it. But it's this was a deliberate move by the government to help reduce its budget deficit without having to, in theory, raise taxes. It would have been much more honest just to raise taxes, and people knew what were paying, what they were paying, and that they were not being cheated out of income adjustment because they're understating the actual inflation rate.
And as we wrap up today, can you tell people more, please, about what they can expect when they bookmark Shadow Stats and all of your latest reports and material?
Shadow Stats is a subscription service in terms of my publishing a regular or somewhat evolving newsletter, series of newsletters on what's happening in the current economic scene. I also have on my website a page, you know, shadowstats.com, but the site page has right in the upper right-hand corner a big column. It's called a daily update. And there I put in the analysis whenever there's a new economic release, and I'll give you my insights, because what I look at here is not necessarily what you get in the headline press, and along with stories that are in the newsletters. You don't have to subscribe to the newsletters to see that, but we always do welcome new subscribers, and the subscription service runs $175 a year, $89 for 6 months.
It's certainly a unique service. There's nothing like it online. John Williams, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Chris. Pleasure talking to you.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. Goldseek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. OneGold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. OneGold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through OneGold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, OneGold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.